Well, I would like to show you a couple of things on the screen. And honestly, I'm a little bit glad that we have the youngest ones out of the room because these are odd. What I'd like you to do is tell me, the image is upside down, right? The picture's upside down. But if you stare at it a second, can you tell who that is? Most are nodding your heads. Let's rotate it one to the right, and then upside right. Do you see what's happening? When you look at an upside down image that's been manipulated, okay, who is it? But really? Okay, I want to show you another one. Who is this?
Bond, James Bond.
Well, I forgot the actor's name, but you kind of rotate him right side up, and what do you have? Very strange. You see what our brains are doing? Let's go one more. Hello, it's me. Who is that? It's Adele. You think I have an Adele thing, but you roll it around a little bit, and wow. Kim, thank you. Kim didn't want to show those because he worried about upset stomachs, you know, but you see what starts to happen. Your brain plays tricks as we adjust our perception. You've read about those experiments at universities when students are given specialized eyewear. They're glasses that are fitted with mirrors in such a way that everything they see during all the waking hours of their life are turned upside down. And it's disorienting and frankly even dangerous because you can't drive, you can't read, you can't cook, you can't dress, you can't go on Facebook. I mean, everything about that experience is very odd, and so they measure how long it takes for your brain to kind of right side up everything. And it happens surprisingly quickly. Within hours or even just a few short days, all of those same college students whose eyewear during all of their waking hours, set with mirrors to flip everything upside down, they do fine. They can read, they can study, they can participate, they can walk, they can do all those things important to their lives. Until they take off the glasses and then the whole thing starts over again and everything is upside down again. This unnerving, troubling manner of things. Well, some have called this Jesus' inaugural address. I'm not so sure that's an apt description. Instead, I would rather call this part of Matthew's gospel Jesus' opus. You know what an opus is? The beginning, the introduction, the first work. Some might call it in academic circles the prolegomenon. It's a way that provides a sort of framework for all that is to follow. All of Jesus' teaching, all of Jesus' preaching, all of Jesus' acts of compassion, and his challenge to those in authority. This opus will provide the themes that are to come for the rest of the gospel. We'll see the themes repeated. We'll hear the melodies repeated, and the cadence, and the verses, and all of the phrases will come back again over and over in such a way that for the rest of Jesus' ministry, for the rest of Jesus' life, for his death, for his resurrection, we'll see it. We'll see Jesus like this new lawgiver, this sort of reincarnation of Moses, the new and fulfilling spokesperson for God's big plan, God's intention and love for the world. I tried to read it with a little bit of drama. I hope not too much so, but this part of the Sermon on the Mount is beautifully crafted by Matthew. He sets it up in such a way that it's almost like we're being enticed or teased or drawn in. There's suspense. There's anticipation, right? Jesus sees the crowds. Well, short phrase, but anybody who had ever read from the book of Exodus would have known what? Jesus sees the crowds. God's seeing the suffering of the Israelites in their slavery in Egypt. Right? Jesus goes up the mountain. Well, there again, anybody who had ever read the book of Exodus would know that when the main character goes up the mountain, something's going to happen. For Moses, it was to receive the 10 words, the 10 commandments, the great gift that would mark the people. The disciples come, and I suppose vicariously as readers now from all these generations later, we get to sort of peer over the fence and watch. We get a front row spot. And then Jesus sits down as if in the posture of the teacher. All the ears are open, all the eyes are wide, all the voices are silent, and all the bodies are leaning forward. He began to speak and taught them, saying, what? Yeah, blessed. The very first word, blessed. I mean, of all the words he could have chosen, of all the other notes that he could have played in the opus, of all of the other truths that he could have claimed, he starts with that, with blessed. In Greek, it's makarioi, blessed. English is wonderful, but sometimes when it gets to religious vocabulary, it runs a little thin, sounds sort of esoteric, sounds sort of religious. What is blessed? What does it mean to be blessed? It means enviable, favored by God, held in esteem, those who are honored. I suppose it's useful to remember that in Matthew's world, at this particular place in time, this audience of Matthew, this society into which Jesus first arrives, is one that is carefully built on a system of honor and shame. You remember? This stratified way of organizing society, right? Those with the most honor at the top and those with the most shame at the bottom. And you just didn't mess with that ranking. You just didn't wander in to thinking differently about how all that is stacked up. And then the objective, of course, becomes to keep your account. Keep your account of honor, not lose any ground, not give away something. Whatever you do, don't be shamed. Don't look funny. Don't be awed or take risks. This layered way of being was such that you couldn't look into the eyes of someone who had a higher honor status than you did. This code, this way of organizing society was so precise that, well, you didn't dare sit in the synagogue in front of or above someone with more honor than you. So carefully organized that you wouldn't dare marry outside anyone of your honor level. Now, in some ways, to contemporary ears, that sounds odd, but maybe in other ways, that sounds so true. Jesus' opus, Jesus' first words of his first sermon, this primer, this opening comment that would signal the message that's to come. Blessed are the... And then I have dot, dot, dot written here. Blessed are the what? Do you remember? How can it be? Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit. And I, in my mind's eye, wonder if the disciples are sitting there wrinkling their eyebrows. You know, what did he say? Blessed are those who mourn. Did they exchange glances? What's he talking about? Blessed are the meek, or we might interpret that as humiliated. Blessed are the humiliated. At that point, did they start to shake their heads? Or blessed are those who hunger and thirst? I wonder if they scoffed under their breath. I wonder if they thought about leaving and finding a better teacher. Look, for something that sounds better to their ears. It may have sounded to them like crazy talk. may have sounded to them like crazy talk with these who God favors, who God loves, these ones most esteemed in our community. Poor, mourning, humiliated, hungry, Jesus, you're turning our world upside down. Mainline, progressive, sophisticated, educated, enlightened, inclusive preachers, maybe like me, we're quite fond of saying that God is unconditionally accepting. We're quite fond of announcing that God is impartial. We like to say that God is indiscriminate, that God is eager to embrace all people equally. But is that really true? It seems that God plays favorites, that God is inclined toward some before others, that God favors certain kinds of people, and it may not be the kinds of ones that we would think. The poor in spirit, those who are empty of soul, drained of life, who are exhausted in their faith, those God favors. That God favors those who mourn, the ones with tears in their eyes. Some loss of something that was important, loss of someone that mattered, them blessed, that God would bless the humiliated, the ones blamed for society's ills, the ones who seem to be the target of collective anxiety and anger, them, the hungry and thirsty ones, how can it be, the ones left longing for something better, for something good. God, you're turning me upside down. I think God is busy with us, and sometimes that's hard. It's unnerving and unsettling, like upside down pictures of James Bond. It's hard. Just when we thought we had things figured out, Jesus interrupts. Jesus starts to call us and provoke us and activate us for a purpose that's larger than ourselves. God asking us to undo the layers of this world. God asking us to upset the scorekeeping that we love. God asking us to go against the grain. Loving us into something new. Loving us into wisdom and compassion. Loving us into urgency. Loving us into love. How can it be? I'm going to finish this sermon with about 60 seconds that belong to you. I've done this before, and I'm putting you on the spot, and you have this little activity that I'm going to invite you to do. It won't be long, and you'll hear the chords, you'll hear the strains of the song that we're going to sing together, but don't stand up yet, because during these, I don't know, 60 seconds or so, would you look around at maybe two people or three people or four? Can you make eye contact with them? I don't know. Maybe there's somebody that you know and love. Maybe it's somebody you're mad at. Maybe it's somebody you disagree with. But would you look them in the eye and become God's spokesperson? Would you voice this opus of Jesus and just say three simple words? Blessed are you. Would you? Ready, go.